So I want to start with a bit of a confession, and my confession is this. I'm addicted to Radio 4. And if that's not sad enough, the particular part of Radio 4 that I really love every morning, and I haven't heard it here, unfortunately, but I usually listen to every morning, it's the business news. Now, isn't that sad? But a few weeks ago, they were talking about Italy owing $1.9 trillion. I can't remember what it was that they owed, but I just know there were 1.9 trillion of them. But then I thought, I like doing little, when I get bored, I do kind of mental arithmetic sums in my head. I'm sure you do the same thing. And I worked out that if it had been Smarties, say Italy owed 1.9 trillion Smarties, that would be about 6 packets of Smarties for every man, woman and child on the planet. And I thought, that is an awful lot of Smarties. So, the heads of Europe, Angela Merkel and the rest of the crowd, say that Europe is in crisis. Well, I'm sure they're right. But quite honestly, they don't make crises like they used to, do they? I remember... That wasn't even meant to be funny. I remember the early 70s, so I haven't actually retired that early. And in the early 70s, I just finished my education. Well, actually, it was the other way around, quite honestly. The University of London had about as much of me as they could possibly be reasonably expected to suffer. And so I left. And... I went along to an employment exchange, which is what they used to call job centres in those days, and they sort of looked at me rather sorrowfully, looked at my education record, and obviously decided I was a no-hoper, and said, well, you'll have to come and work for us. So I did. But in the early 1970s, nobody really worked, as far as I could see. I think I was the only one working. I was working for £25 a week, so I could understand why nobody worked. But the streets in London, all those little square, beautiful squares in the centre of London, were piles of rubbish, because nobody collected the rubbish. There were huge, great mountains of rubbish in all the parks, the squares, even the streets. There were these great mountains of rubbish. And it wasn't just rubbish, it was rotten, stinking, rat-infested rubbish. And even electricity was an uncertain affair, because the power workers who provided electricity were on strike most of the time. So you got electricity sometimes. Sometimes you got electricity, and sometimes you didn't get electricity. Most of the offices and factories were closed. They were told they had to close for 2 days a week, so they were only working for 3 days a week. So we had this thing called the three-day week, where people went to work for 3 days a week, because there just wasn't enough electricity. So it's kind of like living in a third world country. So how did I respond to this? How did I, as a young, educated, sort of, a politically aware individual, respond to this crisis? Well, I mainly got stoned and read Superman comics. So I want to introduce you to Superman comics. Here's a Superman comic. So Superman comics first appeared in 1939. The first Superman comic appeared in the United States in 1939. It cost 10 cents. One of those very first comics was sold in November for $2 million. So that's quite good. If you collect those, then you've done pretty well. But millions of these have been sold. Millions of these have been sold since 1939. They appear all over the place. I love them. I really love Superman comics. So what are Superman comics about? Why do they sell in their millions, if not tens of millions? I think it's because they're kind of about good and evil, really. In Superman appears as a kind of ordinary person, in a sense. His ordinary name's Clark Kent, and he's a journalist. And he's a rather sort of diffident, slightly sort of dowdy journalist. Very kind of ordinary man. You wouldn't notice him if he was walking down the street. But he has this other persona in which he's Superman, and he fights evil. But it's not just Superman. There's a whole kind of galaxy of superheroes. This particular one involves Superboy and Zarian. Zarian's a nasty, nasty bit of work. Zarian's the baddie. So, what we're looking at here, I think, is we're looking at archetypes. Archetypes are what make any film, any novel, any story kind of work. A typical kind of archetype that you come across in films and stories is the young hero. And sure enough, in here you've got Superboy, the young hero. And a typical story involving the young hero is, the young hero is always quite naive. The young hero is all quite naive, thinks that they can overcome all of the evil in the world, in the universe, if you like. But often the young hero fails. The young hero is actually overcome by evil and dies or appears to have died. And then, miraculously, a short time later, they're kind of resurrected. They come alive again and they go on to greater things. So you find that story in Lord of the Rings. You find it in the New Testament, don't you? It's a standard kind of story that you'll find in legends and fables throughout the world. So, Buddhism has got its superheroes. And the superhero we're looking at today is Amoghasili. So Amoghasili, as Jan of Arc has told us, is the Green Buddha, the Buddha of the North. Amoghasili lives in the forests of the north, beautiful, dark, green forests, below a velvet blue sky, a deep velvet blue sky. And Amoghasili is associated with energy, the Vajra. Again, Jan of Arc gave a very good exposition of the Vajra. Try and keep us, close your eyes now, please. Here we have the Vajra. Yeah? Beautiful. Okay. Of course, this isn't a real Vajra. If this is a real Vajra, if this contained all the energy of the universe, I wouldn't be holding it up here. A beautiful symbol of reality. I kind of think of it as the, you've probably all heard of the Big Bang Theory, you know, this idea that the universe was created out of what physicists call a singularity, that is a sort of tiny amount of enormously concentrated energy, and then it kind of explodes in this kind of super, super nuclear explosion, and this energy expands out and creates the universe. It creates the universe. It creates matter. It creates time. Everything comes out. Well, that's the Vajra. That's the Vajra. All the energy in the universe, all the universe in a sense, concentrated in that one beautiful thing. Okay, the Vajra, energy. So Amoghasili has limitless energy. Amoghasili is kind of like a nuclear power station, if you like. Amoghasili has some guardians, and these guardians are rather strange. They're called Shangshangs. And what Shangshangs are, they're half bird and half man. So half of them is a kind of bird and half of them is a man. So they've got the sort of upper torso and head of a man, but the rest of them is a bird. and they crash. They have huge big cymbals which they crash together to make lots of noise. They're not subtle animals at all, really. So a Moga city is associated with a particular realm, a particular part of reality, if you like. And the realm that a Moga city is the kind of guardian of is the realm of the Titans. The Titans. What are Titans? So Titans have lots of energy and they get things done. So the Titans in our world are bankers, industrialists, politicians. People who at the moment don't get a particularly good name for themselves. But the thing about these people is they have masses of energy. Yeah, they have masses of energy, don't they? They have masses of energy and they get things done. They get things done. They are, yeah, achievers. And Moga City, actually the name Moga City means unobstructed success. Unobstructed success. He can do anything. He can do anything. Now, Moga City is a Buddha, an archetypal Buddha. He's not going to come through the door this evening. Yeah? Good if he did. I'd get a fantastic reputation as a speaker if he did. I'd be mentioned at every sip for it then on. But it's probably not going to happen. But of course, there was on this earth, about 2,500 years ago, a real man who became what we now call the Buddha. And that man, as we've already mentioned, was called Siddhartha Gautama. So Siddhartha Gautama lived in northern India, and as has already been mentioned, he was a son of a nobleman. He led a very attractive youth. His life as a youth was very attractive. He had lots of parties and food, lived in palaces. But then he leaves those palaces in order to search for the truth. And after many years of austerity, many years of living in the forest, meditating, fasting, he ends up beside the Niranjana River. So, the Niranjana River. The Niranjana River is a very ordinary river. It's a kind of quite shallow, windy river. Even today, 2,500 years later, it probably hasn't changed very much. There are shallows, there are sandbanks, there are palm trees beside the river, there are cows wandering around the river, drinking in the river. The Buddha is very weak after his fasting. Mythology says he's been living on one grain of rice a day. He knows that this fasting is not working in the sense that he's not achieving what he wants to achieve, which is to understand the truth of suffering. So he takes some sustenance and then he sits underneath one of these palm trees beside the river, and he takes this vow. He takes this vow that he's going to sit underneath a tree, the Buddha here is sitting beneath a tree, and he's going to sit there until he becomes enlightened. So here we have the Buddha sitting beneath a tree in meditation. So what happens next? Well, we've already talked about this, but it's worth talking about again. A number of things happen. Mara, the baddie, Zarian, remember? Yeah? Mara, the baddie, is distraught, upset. Mara does not want to see a human being become enlightened. So Mara has these two devices to prevent the Buddha becoming enlightened. One is his daughters, very, very attractive, seductive daughters. They're kind of like lap dancers, if you like. So they try to distract the Buddha from his purpose. They try to prevent the Buddha getting enlightened. And that doesn't work. So his other device, his other strategy, is his sons. So his sons are a rather nasty lot of people. They come with their spears, their sticks, and their stones to attack the Buddha. That doesn't kind of really work for me, sticks and stones and things like that. You know, if you live in Bethnal Green, that doesn't really work at all. It's kind of, imagine if through that door we didn't have a Moga City coming in, but we had a group of terrorists with kind of hoods and Kalashnikovs. That's what you kind of got to imagine. It's that scary, you know. It's that scary. And again, what does the Buddha do? The Buddha does nothing. The Buddha just sits there in meditation, undistracted, unmoved, just sits with this going on. He doesn't respond. Now, I want to look at that. I want to look at that tiny little episode just before the Buddha's enlightenment, because I think there's a huge amount in that. And for me, what it's all about is quite simple. It's about a very basic human instinct, and that instinct is fear. For me, this incident is about fear. So what is fear? There's all sorts of fear, isn't there? We can be fearful of coming on retreat. I remember my first retreat, I was terrified. I was obnoxious for about a week before the retreat because I was absolutely... The thought of having to share my room with somebody else was absolutely horrible. And even sitting on the minibus was terrifying enough. I might have to talk to some funny people with probably some funny ideas. And I really was not a happy bunny at all. So that's fear. There's all sorts of fears. We can be fearful of all sorts of things. We can be fearful of being liked. We can be fearful that we're going to be made redundant. It's endless, isn't it? And it comes in all sorts of flavours. I mean, we've got all these other words, haven't we? Like anxiety, worry, agitation, concern, even apprehension, even diffidence and things like that. But I think they're all at heart, we're talking fear, aren't we? And what happens? What happens when we experience fear? Well, for me, it limits me. It constrains me. It holds me back. My whole kind of perspective narrows when I'm fearful, when I'm anxious. Yeah, it all kind of goes down. I remember one absolutely terrifying incident that happened to me some years ago now. I'm standing on a platform on the underground, and a few yards away from me, a woman starts to climb onto the tracks. There's a train coming in, and I just remember there kind of being frozen with fear, just watching this woman, absolutely terrified, not knowing what to do. I mean, I wasn't even making a decision about what to do. My whole perspective just went wham. I'm just looking at this and horrible. Actually, she wasn't killed or anything like that, but that experience is extreme, but typical of what happens to me in many, many cases when I'm anxious. So how do we respond to fear? How do we deal with fear? What do we do with fear? One of the things is just to avoid it. You just decide, I'm not going on retreat. It's too frightening. Now, you're all very brave because you're all here. So that's great. But we have all sorts of ways of avoiding fear, haven't we? Most of them actually unsuccessful. I remember a woman on a course that I led about a year ago, and she was working for a not very nice boss, and she'd made a mistake, quite a small mistake, and the boss had really kind of torn her apart and been very unpleasant to her. And she told me she decided from that point she was never going to make a mistake in work. You're never going to make a mistake. And I thought, that was very sad. You know, how can you do that? It's kind of impossible. But the stress that she was under, trying to be perfect. And that's one of the things that we do sometimes, isn't it? We try to be perfect. We try never to make mistakes. And it's very, very stressful. Of course, another way that we can deal with fear is we just try to block out the emotion. We distract ourselves. And we've got lots and lots of ways of doing that, haven't we? And there's people outside who make a fortune out of selling us ways of distracting ourselves, don't they? I mean, we can distract ourselves with computer games, gadgets, alcohol. It's endless, isn't it? Endless number of ways in which we can distract ourselves. But behind all of these ways is some, underlying this, is a basic kind of belief, and I hold this belief, I think, that somehow I can fix it. I can fix this worrisome emotion. Somehow I can get rid of it. Somehow I can sort of get it out of my life. I mean, really, I believe this about most of my life. I believe somewhere out there is a rose-covered cottage in a beautiful countryside where I'm going to live for the rest of my life with the perfect partner in blissful happiness. But what I'm doing here is I'm ignoring a kind of basic teaching of Buddhism. And this basic teaching of Buddhism is called the First Noble Truth. So it's said that after the Siddhartha Gautama became enlightened, became the Buddha, he returned to some of his former disciples and gave them a teaching. And that teaching is the Four Noble Truths. So I'm going to only give you the first one. If you want the other three, you'll have to buy the book. The First Noble Truth. So I think I can express the First Noble Truth in just two words. It's very profound, but in some ways it's very simple. So in two words, this teaching is suffering exists. Suffering exists. Okay? So, it's not suffering exists, but we can fix it. It's not suffering exists because we're wicked. It's not suffering exists for me, but not for you. It's not suffering exists because God makes us suffer. It's simply suffering exists. Suffering exists. So suffering exists for all of us unless we're enlightened. Exists for all of us unless we're enlightened. It exists. In some ways, you could say that you could put it in the terms of, I think somebody put it in terms of, bad things happen to good people. Bad things happen to good people. Yet we often can turn it around and think, I'm suffering and it's just me, and perhaps I'm suffering because I'm bad, or I've done something bad, or I've done something wrong. That's not always the case. About 7 years ago, my wife complained of a pain in her leg. And I sort of shrugged my shoulders and said, oh, it'll probably go away, it'll be all right. You know, I'm sure it's just, I don't know what it is, but it'll go away. But she insisted she insisted that I take her to the hospital. So, all right, okay, I'll take you to hospital. We were very lucky because there was a very perceptive neurologist in that hospital who admitted her immediately. She was suffering from a rare neurological disease. And this rare neurological disease dictated that her own autoimmune system, which ought to have protected her, actually systematically destroyed her nerves, destroyed the nerve endings in her body. So it started with her feet, moved up to her legs. Her legs ceased to function, they were effectively paralyzed. Then it started with her hands, moved up her arms, and then headed for her vital organs. Now, this for me was an incredible moment. Yes, the doctors knew what was happening. Yes, they could give it a name. Yes, they could describe it in detail, and they knew what would happen. But no, they could do nothing about it. Now, in fact, for some strange reason, after 3.5 months, the condition abated, and to a large extent, she recovered. And today, she can walk and feed herself and live a pretty normal life. But there was a tremendous teaching there for me. It was a moment of me having to fully face suffering. I was just thinking about Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha's response to suffering. What does the Buddha do? Well, we know. He sits and he faces it fully. He stares suffering in the face. How often do we do that? How often do we sit with suffering? How often do we sit with all these strong, worrisome emotions? It's very counterintuitive, isn't it? Not responding. We want to do something. We want to fix it. You know, I can remember myself in that hospital. You know, why can't we do something? Why can't we do something here? You know, wanting to fix it. It's a tremendous human impulse. But there are lots of things we can't fix, can we? You know, I'm getting old. Can I fix that? No, I can buy anti-wrinkle cream to the end of time. It's not going to stop me getting old. Some of us have got colds. I think I'm getting a cold. Can I fix that? No, I can't do much about that. You know, we're going to get old, we get ill, and we die. And there's not much we can do about that. There's an awful lot of things in the universe that we can't fix. We can't fix. And this desire to fix it comes, I think, for me, from a kind of very fundamental fear. It's a fear that somehow I won't be able to cope. I won't be able to cope. I was thinking about sort of fear of death. You know, when death comes, will I be able to cope? Will I be able to cope? What will it be like? You know, and that's the fear of when I thought about that retreat, going on that retreat, will I be able to cope with going on retreat? How will I cope with these funny people? But what actually happens when we do what Siddhartha Gautama did, when we actually sit there and we face these very powerful emotions, we just sit with them. So I found a story, and I'm going to read this story out because I think it answers that question very well. So this is a story about a man who goes to India in the 1960s. And this man is determined to get rid of his negative emotions. He has struggled with anger. He has struggled with lust. He struggles against laziness, and he struggles against his own pride. But mostly, he wants to rid himself of fear. His meditation teacher tells him to stop struggling. But he takes this as just another way of explaining how he should overcome his obstacles. So finally, his meditation teacher, probably in despair, sends him to go and meditate in the foothills. So he's sent off to this tiny little hut on the edge of the jungle to meditate on his own. So he arrives at the hut, he shuts the door and settles down to practice. As it gets dark, he lights 3 small candles. So he's meditating in the dark. It's midnight. He hears a noise in the corner of the room. And in the darkness, he sees a very large snake. It looks to him like a king cobra. It sits in front of him, swaying. All night he is totally alert, watching the snake. He can't take his eyes off the snake. He just sits there, rather like me on that underground platform, watching the snake. He's so afraid he can't move. I know that emotion. There's just him, the snake, and fear. Just before dawn, the last candle goes out, and he begins to cry. He cries not in despair, but from tenderness. He feels the longing of all the animals and people in the world. He knows their alienation. He knows their struggle. And he accepts. Wholeheartedly and completely, he accepts that he is angry, that he has experienced anger, that he has been jealous, that he has resisted, that he has struggled, and he has always been afraid. He also accepts that he is precious beyond measure. He is both wise and foolish, rich and poor, and totally unfathomable. He feels so much gratitude that in the total darkness, he stands up and he walks towards the snake and he bows. He then falls soundly asleep on the floor. When he awakes, the snake is gone. He's never sure whether the snake was in his imagination or was real. But it doesn't seem to matter. His intimacy with fear means that his dramas collapse and the world around him finally gets through. So I love that phrase there, intimacy with fear. And I wonder whether Siddhartha Gautama, sitting beneath the tree beside the Naranjana River, was intimate with fear. I don't know. I've no idea at all. But I remember a saying of a Zen master called Dogen Zenji. Dogen Zenji said that enlightenment is intimacy with all things. Enlightenment is intimacy with all things. So maybe he was. But I think the point of this story is that when we can be with these emotions, when we can open ourselves fully and wholly and honestly to these kind of overpowering and potentially kind of overwhelming emotions, something happens, something radically transformational happens to us. And in that transformation, what happens is that compassion arises. Compassion arises. That is what happens to this man in the forest. That is what happens to this man. Compassion arises. And that is what happens in a Buddha, when a Buddha becomes enlightened. Compassion arises. And that compassion, that compassion is something very special. That compassion is what we're talking about when we do the Metta-bhavana. It's universal, unconditional compassion. It has no limits, no conditions whatsoever. No limits, no conditions whatsoever. Isn't it easy to be generous when other people are generous to you? Isn't it easy to be nice to people who are nice to you? But that's not what we're talking about. That's not the compassion of a Buddha. The compassion of a Buddha is unconditional and universal. So, for me, there is something magical in fear. Because fear is so universal, we all experience fear, don't we? We all experience fear. Animals experience fear. Every human being on this planet experiences fear. Fear of hunger, fear of thirst, fear of oppression, fear of so many things, fear of illness, fear of disease, fear of death. We all feel it, and when we feel it, we can connect with all those other human beings. It's a common experience that connects me to those other human beings on the planet. I know their fear, I understand their fear. I can empathize with them, and that connects me with them. That connects me with them. Pema Chodron said that only to the extent that we expose ourselves to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us. Only to the extent that we expose ourselves to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us. So I think what she's saying in there is only when we really open ourselves, only when we're vulnerable to these things, these emotions like fear and suffering, only when we can be with them, only when we can do what Siddhartha Gautama did and just sit with those emotions, be with those emotions, allow them in fully and wholeheartedly, only then can we discover what is within us that is indestructible, the Vajra within us. That's when the Vajra appears. That's when we know the Vajra. That's when we find out who we really are and discover our real strength. And in a sense, we've been doing that every day. In a sense, when you're doing the mindfulness of breathing, you're sitting with the breath. Yes, you're sitting with the breath as it is. Whether it's shallow, or whether it's deep, whether it's fast or whether it's slow. You just sit with it. You just sit with it. You just sit with it, however it is. Yeah? And some of you have got colds, and some of you find the incense difficult, and for all those things that affect us. But you just sit with it. You just sit with the breath, however it is. And when you're doing the metta bhavana, all sorts of emotions can come up. You bring your good friend to mind, and suddenly you discover you're incredibly jealous of your good friend. Or something. I've done it myself many times. But you just sit with that. You just sit with that. However it is. You just let that be. So in that sense, I think when we meditate, yes, that's what we're doing. We're trying to be, in a sense, like the Buddha. That's what we're aiming to. That's what metta bhavana is about. That's what that last beautiful stage of the metta bhavana is about. Moving towards, being like the Buddha, moving towards that universal, unconditional metta for all beings. That's what the Buddha experiences, and that's what we're trying to kind of anticipate. I just want to return to Amoghya Siddhi. Amoghya Siddhi, Jnana Vacha said, is an aspect of the enlightened mind. Because the enlightened mind is so kind of vast and complex. We can talk about it as compassion, we can talk about it as energy, we can talk about it as unlimited patience, we can talk about it as loving kindness, we can talk about it in all of these different ways. All of these properties, all of these mandala Buddhas are properties of the enlightened mind. It is all of these things. And none of these things. The enlightened mind is indescribable. It's well beyond the world of words. It's completely ineffable. So the nearest we can get to is describing it in all these many different ways. It's rather like this lovely story, you know it, but I'm going to repeat it. The story of the three blind men and the elephant, isn't it? Yeah? You all know that story. These three blind men come, and they come, and there's an elephant there. So the first one sort of grabs it by the tail and says, the elephant's like a rope. Next one grabs it by the trunk and says, no, an elephant's like a pipe. And another one grabs it by the leg and says it's like a tree. So they've all grasped a bit of the elephant, but none of them can comprehend what a whole elephant is like. So we're like that. We're grasping these mandala Buddhas, trying to reach out to the enlightened mind. One aspect of Amoghya Siddhi that I didn't mention before, one quality of Amoghya Siddhi is fearlessness. And I actually think it's that fearlessness that is at the heart of Amoghya Siddhi, because I think if I was fearless, if I really could reach out and touch fear and move beyond it, I could move beyond it, then you would have kind of unlimited energy, wouldn't you? You would have, there would be nothing in your way, there would be nothing stopping you. So Amoghya Siddhi, unobstructed success, that's where it comes from, that's where the energy comes from, that's when this ability to accomplish anything and everything comes from. Fearlessness, I think that's at the root of it. And Amoghya Siddhi is on the other side. I just move around. So Amoghya Siddhi has his hand up like this. So this is what we call a mudra. It's a kind of hand signal. This is the mudra of fearlessness. This is the mudra of fearlessness. So that's what you see when you look at a Moga Siddhi, the mudra of fearlessness. An open hand, yes? Yeah? Open hand. Open to whatever is out there. Completely open, nothing held back. And it's called the Abhaya Mudra, the mudra of fearlessness. So tonight I've tried to introduce a Moga Siddhi. And to an extent, hopefully, we've met a Moga Siddhi. And this retreat is called Meeting the Buddha. But there's something more important here. That night when Siddhartha Gautama became the Buddha, something amazing happened in the world, in the cosmos. A man became enlightened. That was momentous enough. That was momentous enough. But for me, there's something even more profound and more significant about the Buddha's enlightenment, and it's this. After the Buddha became enlightened, he said, everyone, every man, woman and child can also become enlightened in this lifetime, in this lifetime. Buddhism doesn't invite you just to meet the Buddhas, although that would be profound and transformative enough. It doesn't ask you even to just worship the Buddhas. It's about becoming a Buddha. It's about becoming a Moga Siddhi. Thank you.